You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 7th of December 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, coming to you live from Studio One here in London with me, Emma Nelson. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, could the fight over Egypt's political future be drawn along religious lines? We'll assess the latest protests in Cairo. Also ahead, following Starbucks' decision to pay £20 million in tax, we examined the consumer boycott. Does it work? And if not, why does anyone bother?
It's sharpened by the sense that some of the people at the top have paid themselves very large salaries and have got away with it, particularly in banking.
Plus, it being Friday, we'll head to the cinema and we'll try not to fall asleep. We'll ask why this season's crop of blockbusters tops a buttock-numbing two-hour mark.
Bilbo Baggins. I'm looking for someone to share in an adventure.
I can't just go running off into the blue. I am a Baggins.
Wait!
Of Bagend.
That would be the Hobbit enjoying second, third and fourth breakfasts. We'll also hear about Brazil's charismatic new boy on the political block. We'll head to the slopes as Switzerland's ski season begins and we'll play you some great music too. All that to come here in the next hour on Midori House. But first, let's catch up on the latest world headlines from David Spencer.
Around 10,000 demonstrators have massed in Cairo as Egyptian opposition leaders reject calls by President Morsi to enter a national dialogue. Protesters have broken barricades around the presidential palace and climbed on tanks deployed in the area. The opposition is angry with the president for refusing to withdraw his new powers in his televised statement on Thursday. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has been visiting a refugee camp on the Turkey-Syria border to see for himself the conditions for thousands of people displaced by the Syrian conflict. He's called on the international community not to ignore the suffering of those that have had to flee the fighting.
I urge the international community, and in particular the Security Council, to stand united and act decisively to end that crisis. I appeal to the international community, do not close your eyes while people are suffering.
The exiled political leader of Hamas, Khaled Mashal, is making his first ever visit to Gaza to mark the organization's 25th anniversary. Mr. Mashal hasn't set foot in the Palestinian territories since leaving the West Bank in 1967. He's told a press conference during his visit that Gaza has always been in his heart. A 1-metre-high tsunami wave has struck the city of Ishinomaki in northeastern Japan after a strong earthquake off the coast. Buildings shook in Tokyo during the tremor, which happened more than 200 miles away under the Pacific Ocean. The polls have closed in parliamentary and presidential elections in Ghana. A tight race is expected between President John Mahama and Nana Akufo-Addo. There have been complaints about delays because of long queues. This voter, Michael Akpabli, waited patiently to cast his vote.
Although I'm handicapped, I don't want to stay for somebody to choose somebody for me. So as a citizen, I also have to exercise my franchise. That is why I'm here.
The unemployment rate in the United States has fallen to a four-year low. The unexpectedly strong performance saw 146,000 jobs added in November. Experts had expected Superstorm Sandy to have a negative impact on the figures. Jeffrey Jores from employment services firm Manpower Group believes faster growth, though, is needed. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
David, thank you very much. The time is 4 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Op London, du var Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, desde Londres.
Holanda.
London,
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
Prepare to fight for Islam. That's been the call to supporters of Mohamed Morsi following Friday prayers in Cairo. Egypt is experiencing its worst protests since the downfall of Hosni Mubarak, and the pressure on President Morsi to make concessions is not abating. Opposition figures have so far rejected offers of talks to abate the crisis. Some of Morsi's key supporters have abandoned him. Well, to bring us up to date, we can talk to Eric Traeger, Next Generation Fellow at the Washington Institute in DC and Muslim Brotherhood expert. He joins us on the line now. Welcome to Midori House, Eric. As we've just heard in the news, 10,000 people are gathering in Cairo, preparing for a night of protests, one can imagine. What can we expect to happen in the next few hours?
Well, what I think we're going to have is some sort of, prolonged chaos, both within that vicinity, but in Egypt more generally. Bottom line is that Mohamed Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood have asserted far greater power than they were elected for, and that has very quickly catalyzed a unification of very disparate non-Islamist opposition elements. And those opposition elements' demands are hardening as each day goes by. So yesterday was an opportunity for Morsi to step back from some of his power grab. In other words, maybe withdraw the presidential decree through which he declared unchecked power, maybe postpone the constitutional referendum, which is, of course, on a constitution draft that the Brotherhood rammed through without any non-Islamist input. But he gave the opposition neither. And at this point, it's just very hard to see how this ends peacefully.
Mr. Morsi didn't give any concessions yesterday. Does he now find himself absolutely boxed insofar as he cannot back down now?
That's certainly the way he sees it. From Morsi's perspective, he is still fighting the same enemies that the Brotherhood has had in reality for many years. He sees himself as fighting remnants of the old regime, remnants of the security forces, but also fighting people that the Brotherhood would call apostates, infidels. Christians are being highlighted in the Brotherhood's paper as among the anti-Brotherhood opposition. These are elements that the Brotherhood is historically hostile to, some for much better reasons than others, and he's unlikely to concede to people that he views as, frankly, infidels. Not only that, he's not going to concede, more importantly, because he's positive that he can win. He's positive that this power grab is not something that the majority of the country is angered by, and he's even more positive that the Brotherhood and the Salafists and the Islamists can win the referendum on the Constitution. And when you think you're going to win, why back down?
Are we seeing, therefore, a surfacing of fundamental problems that were going to emerge anyway? You talk about the religious divisions. And as I mentioned a moment ago, the call to supporters of Morsi have been told to fight for Islam. Does this actually have very little to do with politics at the end of the day?
I'm not so sure about that. I mean, I don't think the current standoff was inevitable. No doubt. I mean, what you're saying about the divide between Islamists and non-Islamists, especially given just how fervently Islamists are attached to their doctrine, yeah, that debate was always going to be a feature of post-Mubarak Egyptian politics. But the truth is that Morsi's power grab and the way in which he and the Muslim Brotherhood forced through this constitution and are rushing it to a referendum is really what sparked the current conflict. There was no reason why this necessarily had to erupt in such instability and violence with a number of protesters dying. And that's really a result of, first of all, the stubbornness with which the Brotherhood has rushed this through. And secondly, and this is the most important point, the fact that the Muslim Brotherhood has mobilized its people to attack the protesters, essentially using organized gang violence.
This is what surprised me when I've been looking at the footage, is the degree of entrenchment that each side is engaged in. Is this the way that the Egyptians think that a democracy is organized?
Well, I don't think that, democracy really comes into the equation. You have two groups right now with essentially mutually exclusive goals. One group wants an Islamist state, but more importantly, is insisting on an extent of power to which it was not elected for, as well as a fast constitution that gives Islamists a greater foothold. The other side completely rejects that, and of course, Morsi signaled yesterday that he's not open to compromise. So yes, I mean, the unwillingness of either side to compromise is certainly part of what's fueling the explosive environment, but really what set off that fuse is Morsi's decree and then his rush of the Constitution.
That's absolutely accepted in terms of the fact that Morsi's decree was surprising, I think, to everybody, and I think even Morsi himself was surprised about the reaction. But are we looking at a country now which will decide to do its own business and seal its own fate simply through protest and violence on the streets of and in Tahrir Square?
I mean, that's unfortunately what it's going to be until one side finds a way to work more effectively with the other. Look, I don't think we should completely absolve the non-Islamists. You know, the non-Islamists walked out of a constituent assembly that, while yes, it was Islamist dominated because of the elections. But on the other hand, you know, the extent to which the Brotherhood has been non-inclusive, the total failure to concede anything, the deal that the Brotherhood has cut with the military, which is helping the Brotherhood force this constitution down the country's throats, and which is allowing Morsi to declare the power grab that he did, is really what's driving the current instability.
You mentioned there the idea of deals being cut. I remember when the elections were in full throw and an expert came on Monocle 24 to say that at the end of the day, regardless as to what the people say, it is always about deals being cut in the background. Do you think this is actually a possible way of getting out of this problem?
Well, the problem is that there's no apparent deal that's being hatched between anyone in the opposition and the Muslim Brotherhood. Right now, the military and the Brotherhood, the two strongest forces, one holding the weapons, the other being politically capable, are on the same page. And you could see that in the new constitution, where the military has a number of perquisites thrown its way, including full autonomy but relative autonomy over its budgets. The fact that the Minister of Defense has to come from the military, the fact that the Minister of Defense is the commander of the armed forces. So you have the two strongest forces on the same page. That really leaves the weaker force, the non-Islamists, out of the picture. And that's a big part of the reason, I think, why they're not likely to compromise, because they believe that any kind of compromise constitutes co-optation.
And very briefly, finally, Eric, if you may, what kind of damage is this doing to Egypt's international reputation?
Well, it's doing a lot of damage. You have to look at the stock market over the last week or so. It's lost another couple billion dollars. It lost $5 billion 2 weeks ago Monday. So it's doing a lot of damage to the prospects for investment in that country. And we have to remember that the Muslim Brotherhood's economic program is focused largely on attracting foreign direct investment. So that's really what makes the Brotherhood's uncompromising outlook so hard to explain.
Eric Traeger from the Washington Institute, thank you as ever for coming on the show. You're listening to Midori House. Stay with us, because in a moment we'll be looking at a rising star in Brazilian politics.
The bumper December-January issue of Monocle takes a look over the horizon at 2013 and beyond, introducing you to the people you need to work with, giving you an insight into which nations are on the rise, spotlighting the best in retail, and letting you eavesdrop on conversations with the leaders in everything from foreign policy to trim typography. And there's much, much more.
In the affairs section, I head to New York City to meet the foreign ministers of Sweden, Brazil and Turkey as they launch their own diplomatic group. And we also go to Basra to see how investment in the port could make that city a regional economic power.
In the business pages, we look north to explore the towns that are set to benefit most from an Arctic resource boom. We also meet the Spanish entrepreneurs who are cooking, inventing, and manufacturing Madrid out of economic trouble, and find out why savvy customers still care where their favourite products are made.
In the edits section, we take you on a 48-hour Christmas shopping spree in Vienna. It's a city that oozes picturesque Christmas spirit, and we visit the best of the city's independent retailers.
The December-January issue also includes our Turkey travel survey and is on sale now. Make sure you have all your holiday reading sorted, and remember, you can buy gift subscriptions at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
The time has just gone 15 minutes past 6 in the evening here in London. That means it's 16:16 in Sao Paulo. Now, could we be hearing a lot more of the name Aécio Neves in the near future? Brazil's former president, Cardoso, has enthusiastically endorsed him as the next leader of the country's centre-right and as possibly the only man able to take on Dilma Rousseff in the 2014 presidential elections. Neves comes from pure political stock and already has a track record of turning a region's fortune around. Plus, by all accounts, he is not without that magical touch of charisma so beloved of successful politicians. Well, to profile Brazil's next man, I'm joined in the studio by the journalist Bruno Garces. Thank you very much, as ever, for coming into the studio, Bruno. Tell us more, then, about Aécio Neves.
Well, Aécio Neves was a very successful governor of the state, one of the richest states in the Union of Minas Gerais from 2003 to 2010. He's currently a senator elected with over 7 million votes. And he also elected his successor. And he's a star in the opposition, which has been seeing its star power waning in the last few years. And some consider that the decision to let José Serra, his internal rival within his party, the PSDB, was a mistake, that it should have been him, the man.
You said that he was senator of Minas Gerais. He had this so-called management shock policy, which turned the area's fortunes around. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, yes, the state was suffering a huge deficit, and he managed to zero the budget in little time, in a little bit over a year. And that was through a series of austerity measures. And that's part of his claim. Part of his claim to fame, I say, I emphasize, because he's also the grandson of what we could describe as a bit of a legendary politician. He's the grandson of Tancredo Neves, who was going to be the first civilian president to take charge after the military coup, but then he died a few days prior to his inauguration, which was one of these ever so many Brazilian tragedies.
The Brazilian former president Cardoso earlier this week said that Neves should take control of the PSDB, the centre-right party, as soon as possible. Why do you think he said that?
Because there is an internal dispute. There is a bloc from São Paulo, Aécio being from another big, important state and rich state, for that matter, Minas Gerais. There's a dispute between these two blocs, which led to José Serra from São Paulo, former governor, having run for president in the last elections without success. I mean, José Serra was known not to be charismatic, of being highly unpopular, and he wasn't. Now, recently, he wasn't even elected for mayor of São Paulo. So, that is one name that is out of the, you know, is out of competition. He's been discarded. So, I think with President Fernando Henrique Cardoso, or FHC as we call him, is pushing for Aécio is because Aécio tends to be a winning ticket.
What do you think Neves could do for Brazil?
That's hard to say what he could. Well, I think he stands a good chance if the economy starts to go badly. And because President Dilma also has the backing of a very important figure, which is President Lula. Who left office with, let's not forget, a legacy and a popularity far higher than that of his predecessor, precisely Mr. Fernando Henrique Cardoso. So I think he stands a good chance if the economy starts doing badly, if Dilma's somewhat, a bit Thatcherite bully style. Some identify her as being this tough iron lady style. If that style starts to revert against her, and Aécio being this smiley type, very charismatic, likable, the guy that you would like to have a beer at the bar. But on the other hand, as I just mentioned, that precisely might be what might offset any chance of that he might have of success, because he's also known to be a bit of a bohemian, a bit of a ladies' man. He's been caught on YouTube slightly tipsy in a bar, although giving generous tips. But so that could turn against him very easily.
Apart from the personal flamboyance that Mr. Neves enjoys, the way you described the threats, you know, what could make the man, are not necessarily political or financial acumen, as you've just said, but the flaws or the chinks in President Dilma's armour. Is it not more important, perhaps, for Neves to have a clearer and stronger and more positive image to present to the Brazilian people?
Possibly so, because at the moment I don't think he is as the wide-known figure as he should be, which is why probably FHC, Fernando Henrique Cardoso, is calling for him to stand up and you know, stand his ground and go for it. Now is your time. Now is your moment, kind of thing, because he hasn't yet shown his face to many in Brazil. I think there are still lots of people who actually don't know who he is.
Bruno Garces, thank you very much as ever for coming into the studio. That was a Brazilian journalist, Bruno Garces. The time has just gone 21 minutes past the hour. You're with Midori House. And you're listening to Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. Now, is Starbucks' pledge to pay 20 million British pounds in tax next year little more than a sweetener? It's above the company's legal obligation, at least, but by all accounts, it's not enough for the hundreds, if not thousands, of irate customers who have encouraged a boycott. When it emerged that Starbucks was among several international firms engaged in enthusiastic tax avoidance, people power took over. It seems the anger is symptomatic of an increasing popular resentment of big business making money while the little guy tightens his belt in a recession, as Ben Page from Ipsos Mori explained a little earlier.
It's sharpened by the sense that some of the people at the top have paid themselves very large salaries and have got away with it, particularly in banking. It's sharpened by the fact that people are under a lot of pressure, and therefore, you know, they want to see, and they also feel their own taxes have gone up in many cases. In Britain, for example, thousands and thousands of people have just been told they're going to be paying a higher rate of tax because of changes made by the government. But it's also, I think, a sense that, you know, in the past, companies have told everybody that they, you know, they buy recycled paper, they try and pay, in Starbucks' case, they try and pay fair prices for coffee beans in Africa. They do all these things. There's a whole industry of what's called corporate social responsibility, where companies produce these reports to show how ethical their dealings are. But it's moved, that stuff, the interesting thing is, with consumers, they get, stuff becomes the new normal. So it's now assumed that you would try and be fair to farmers in the third world. It's assumed you would not use child labour. The next frontier is it's also assumed you would pay a fair rate of taxation rather than trying to minimise your tax bill.
That was Ben Page from Ipsos Mori a little earlier on today. So do corporate boycotts work? I'm joined now by Jeff Jarvis, internet analyst and professor of media at City University in New York. Welcome to Midori House, Jeff. As we've heard just then, people are angry, but this is a very, very rapid reaction from Starbucks in terms of their gesture to pay 20 million British pounds in tax next year. Are you surprised by how quickly Starbucks has acted?
I'm troubled by this because this is legislators in the UK blackmailing Starbucks. This is fairly simple how this works. Laws are passed in governments for taxation. Companies are obligated, have a fiduciary responsibility to minimize their costs, which means includes taxes, and maximize their profit and value for their shareholders. And as the legislators said to Starbucks, Amazon, and Google, everything they're doing is legal. So the problem here is not with the behavior of the companies. The problem is with the laws. And the people who are complaining are the lawmakers. Now, Ms. Hodge, a member of parliament, made it into a matter of saying that, well, it wasn't illegal, but it was immoral. Well, this is a quite strange thing now. So what she's actually asked Starbucks to do is to self-tax, is to decide what tax it should give. Well, probably it's never enough. And it's oddly, that's really a member of the parliament giving up some power. Taxation is the power of the parliament. It's not the power of the corporation. So I'm very, very troubled by this idea that a bunch of legislators who do a very bad job with their own laws can gang up on a company and pick a few, by the way, American companies to pick on here and bully. And I think it's a big problem. The clearer problem here is that we need new tax laws. But there's something else that goes on. They're not happy that, for example, Google uses tax opportunities in Ireland and Bahamas. Well, guess what? There's competition among countries just as there is among corporations. And so countries try to compete to get companies to base there. You know what they do? They offer better tax deals. And the company has a fiduciary responsibility to find the best deals. So everything that happened here was legal. Everything that the British government did was thuggish.
Nonetheless, you talk about this fiduciary duty on the part of the likes of Starbucks, but it was Starbucks itself that offered to pay, in inverted commas, its £20 million donation. Why do you think Starbucks felt like it had to make that gesture?
Ringer by a member of parliament calling them immoral, and then a member of parliament trying to start a consumer boycott against a company that employs a lot of people in Britain. I found it absolutely appalling.
But surely one member of British Parliament, namely Margaret Hodges, is not responsible for the widespread boycott that people were engaged in against Starbucks.
Oh, no, of course she was. She's the one who started this movement. She decided the three companies to pick on, and she did this. No, absolutely. This was using the power of Parliament, I think, to very bad ends.
Do you not think, though, that a company like Starbucks, which sets himself up, as we heard a few moments ago from Ben Page, that decides that it promotes fair trade, it recycles, it tries to engage with the consumer as an ethically positive company, regardless as to whether it has to have legal obligations to carry out such duties. The fact that behind the scenes it is engaged in avoidance of paying tax, is that not a very, very bad PR gesture by Starbucks? And we have to bear in mind that unlike the likes of Amazon, which people are now relying upon for providing good value, and Google, which people rely on as an inherent part of their internet life, something like Starbucks is a little luxury that people can see on the street and go, actually, no, I'm not going to buy my coffee from you today because you don't pay enough tax.
Let me answer your question with a question. How much tax do you voluntarily contribute to government yourself? If you're so high and mighty about this and think that Amazon does, great. How much do you contribute?
How much
do you pay more than you're legally obligated to pay? I'm betting you don't, because you're sane. You follow the laws of the land, and you pay the taxes you are obligated to do. Taxes are not a choice. They are an obligation. They're a good and necessary and wonderful obligation that I happily pay to government, but they are an obligation, and I pay what's decided to be fair is not something that I make up out of nowhere. It's in the law of the land. You're being irrational.
It is an obligation, so why should Starbucks offer to pay more than it is legally obliged to do so next year?
Because they got bamboozled and they got bullied by the thugs in Parliament. End of story, full stop. There's no other reason. If the UK government was one way from Starbucks, then change the law. And who's responsible for that? Margaret Hodges and Parliament, not Starbucks.
What kind of legal precedent do you think this is setting for future decisions when it comes to companies paying tax?
Here's the precedent. It makes the UK into a very hostile environment for business. And if I were a major company, I would find every way to pull as much of the operation as I could out of the UK for fear of this. It also makes it very hostile for the idea that Starbucks has how many thousands of stores around the country that employ how many thousands of Britons? That's what's happening here. Well, basically, what's happening is that Britain finds itself unable to write fair tax laws, number one, and number two, to negotiate treaties with other countries that would disallow these practices they don't like. But if you are the CFO or the CEO of a company, and you are charged with having a responsibility to your shareholders, if you do not maximize that value, you can get sued.
Regardless.
If I just to say, you know what, I'm going to give away all the company's money to my cause, whether that cause is the UK coffers, whether that cause is a charity, right? My shareholder is going to come after my rear end.
Regardless of the gestures of the British MP Margaret Hodges, and also your criticism of the British legal system when it comes to tax legislation, are you nonetheless surprised that such a huge sway of popular anger towards Starbucks may well have been what precipitated Starbucks into making this tax donation, just perhaps as being accepted as the cost of doing successful business.
Story. This was a media story that was amplified by media. We don't need to organize boycotts anymore. If you look at examples of people who have gotten mad at airlines or at banks, I personally started what was called, and I did this inadvertently, Dell Hell. I complained on my blog about not liking my computer and having problems with it, and it went absolutely viral, more than I ever could have imagined. Huge stuff came out. I don't think I'm responsible for this, but the stock went down 20%. And Dell had to change their ways, and they changed their entire structure. In fact, they just announced this week they're now are so good at social media, they're going to start consulting on it as a line of business, which, by the way, is better than PCs as a line of business. Right? So every single consumer makes their own decisions. We don't need to be organized into mobs by politicians and media.
Jeff Jarvis, Professor of Media at City University in New York, thank you very much indeed for joining us. You're listening to Midori House. In the next half hour of Midori House, we'll meet the neighbours in New York, hit the slopes in Switzerland, and we'll ask why this season's blockbusters are a little on the long side.
I think that people taking their family out really want an evening's experience. They want to feel like they've got value for money. I mean, you look at the prices now in the West End, I mean, extraordinarily high, £15-16 for a single adult ticket. If you're taking the whole family out, I think people really do want to feel that the whole night has been spent well.
All that to come, but with the time approaching 32 minutes past the hour, let's get the latest world news headlines from David.
Thank you. Around 10,000 demonstrators have massed in Cairo as Egyptian opposition leaders reject calls by President Morsi to enter a national dialogue. Protesters have broken barricades around the presidential palace and climbed on tanks deployed in the area. The exiled political leader of Hamas, Khaled Mashal, is making his first ever visit to Gaza to mark the organization's 25th anniversary. Mr. Mashal hasn't set foot in the Palestinian territories since leaving the West Bank in 1967. A 1-metre-high tsunami wave has struck the city of Ishinomaki in northeastern Japan after a strong earthquake off the coast. Buildings shook in Tokyo during the tremor, which happened more than 200 miles away under the Pacific Ocean. The polls have closed in parliamentary and presidential elections in Ghana. A tight race is expected between President John Mahama and Nana Akufo-Addo. And the unemployment rate in the United States has fallen to a 4-year low. The unexpectedly strong performance saw 146,000 jobs added in November. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
This is Midori House on Monocle 24, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. Now, if I were able to stay upright on two planks of wood, I would embrace the next item with glee. As it stands, I am woefully unable to ski, as a little boy called George can testify. I mowed him down once. I hope he made a speedy recovery. Nonetheless, for many, today is a great day. The Swiss skiing season begins, which means that every weekend for the next few months will be spent fleeing the city and heading to the slopes. And the good news is that this year the snow is fabulous. And even better, I'm joined in the studio to give me a bit of helping hand in all matters ski by Monocle's very own Colonel Black Run, Robert Bound. And also to tell us more, I'm joined by Kevin Kuntz from the Mount Salvan Palace in Zermatt. Welcome to you both to Midori House. I'll go to you first, Kevin. What's the snow like?
It's fabulous right now. God really means it good with us. We have around 1 metre of fresh snow in the village right now, and up on the mountains it's around 2 to 3 metres.
What does that mean for the skier, Rob?
We already opened up around 275 kilometres of slopes now, and the preparation of the slopes are going to go on, and we will think that in the next week we're going to open up 360 kilometres of the runs.
And I'd like to ask you, Zermatt's a very beautiful town. It's a carless town, or it's a petrolless town, isn't it? And the Matterhorn, I guess, is peeping through the clouds at the moment. It sounds like a pretty sort of beguiling image to be waking up to tomorrow morning. Are all the lifts open? Is it sort of like the perfect picture postcard sort of opening weekend for you guys?
It is really. It's just absolutely fabulous. You know, the snow came at the right time. All the Christmas decorations are already out in the village. And if you go on the webcams, you're going to see slopes. You know, it's just a fairy tale and it's a dream come true.
And I wanted to ask you about these webcams, because this is something, as a keen skier myself, I normally go to the same sorts of places. I'm sorry to say, I normally go to Verbier, though. But that's just a marriage of convenience. But the webcams are a very sort of important thing, aren't they? Do you ever get tempted to shovel a bit more snow to where the camera's pointed?
Robert, that's a good one. No, with an altitude of 3,800 meters where the slopes really start, you don't want to shovel too much around. You won't have enough oxygen to continue with it.
How does the atmosphere in Switzerland change when the skiing season opens? I know that things, you know, palpably are different in Zurich because people have this great weekend destination.
Yes, no, it really comes. You know, it's people get nervous, you know, when the first snow starts to fall. And then they're on the radio listening which slopes are opening, which areas are opening. And everybody gets very excited to go back into the mountain and enjoy the slopes and the fresh air.
Now, as you may have undoubtedly heard a moment ago, I am not the world's greatest skier, and it pains me. So for those who are unable to stay upright on skis, what do you have on offer for us this year to keep us busy?
Listen, I think we have great spas and we have great hotels and restaurants. Shopping is always an issue in the village as well. New shops opened. Bogner's store is just opening tonight with their flagship store. Jack Wolfinson opened up. And it's really a lot to do around it. And also on the slope side, of course, we have challenging slopes, black slopes, but we also have really smooth and nice slopes for guys like me, a little bit overweight and not on the training again.
I wanted to ask you.
You've just spoiled an image I had of you, Kevin. I'm so disappointed.
Listen, pop over and I can promise you it is the right one.
I have to say,
I've just been propositioned on
that. I think you have been propositioned on that. I mean, I'm looking at what Emma's Googling and I'm not entirely sure that fits with the subject. That's not a snow report. That's not a webcam, Emma. I wanted to ask actually about that retail mix. I guess it's a thing of having to get your Swissness and your internationalness sort of perfectly balanced, isn't it? Is that something you sort of have to think about, or is it something that finds its natural sort of equilibrium?
Well, you know, what shall I say? I think, you know, with the Matterhorn in front of you, you already have that Swissness. I think the symbol for whole Switzerland is the mountain, what is just in front of us. But for sure, we also want to balance different experiences on holidays. That means all the spa and pampering issues are for sure important. And shopping is an important part with it. A lot of shops, of course, we geared up for the winter season now. It's a lot of sports shops, family-run sports shops with a great, great number of different brands. And they're really very helpful, those guys.
How have you seen your customer base changing in the last couple of years? And what are you predicting for this season?
The customer base now in wintertime, it's still number one are Swiss. The second one could be between UK and Russians. And the third customer base are Germans. It is very international. We are very lucky. We really have a base of international customers out of Europe, also Norway, Sweden. But also a big chance is coming now from Brazil, where the Brazilians really were preferring North America. But now they want to maybe try the original.
Kevin Kuntz from the Mount Cervin Palace in Zermatt. And, of course, Monocle's Mr. Snow, Robert Bound. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. You're with Midori House. Let's hear from Madonna. Of course, that was Madonna there and Material Girl. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back in a moment to find out why so many blockbusters are pushing the two-hour limit.
As 2012 draws to a close, Monocle has put together a selection of gifts that we'd like to find under the tree this year.
People of all ages turn to the teddy bear as the king of cuddly toys, and Shropshire's Merrythought is the firm to turn to. As the last remaining teddy manufacturer in the UK, its bears have become a sought-after collector's item. Opt for a classic Jackfield and an additional teddy bear picnic set, complete with a tartan blanket, miniature teacups and pots.
From portable coffee bean roasters to special edition parfum, you can find gift inspiration by watching our seasonal slideshow on monocle.com.
The time is 18:42 here in London, and you're listening to Midori House. Now, there is at least one good thing to be said for the modern blockbuster. You get a good deal of bang for your buck. For example, Skyfall clocks in at a substantial 143 minutes long. That is a good value evening, if enough to give you a dead leg. So are these super durations turning cinema-goers off? Worried that if the film's not up to scratch, it'll be a good 2.5 hours of your life that you'll never get back. Our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, spoke to Nick Clark, arts correspondent for The Independent.
It's interesting. We looked at the issue because there's sort of 5 or 6 movies that are basically clocking in, as you say, over 2.5 hours. And we decided to look at whether the biggest 10 films of the year, going back to, say, 82, whether there was any difference in the average time. And we have noticed that actually, no, it's almost the opposite, because the average time, say, in 1982, when it was about 110 minutes, has actually gone up to about 125 minutes. And if you look at some of the biggest films of this year, Skyfall, The Dark Knight, and Avengers Assemble, they're all over 2.5 hours. So I think as long as the films are good, audiences have no problem with it.
And what are the reasons for that? I believe that digital technology played a big part on that as well.
Well, that's quite an interesting point. I was talking to a friend from Empire magazine, and he suggested that digital actually has a big impact on this, partly because it's cheaper than film previously, so actually directors can shoot more. And another reason, possibly, which I think is very interesting, is that in the old days with film, cutting and editing was a much harder process. So if filmmakers had taken out a part of the film, putting it back in, they really had to want that scene back in, and many just left it out. Whereas with digital, and not at the ease of editing these days, that filmmakers can just put scenes back in as well. So there's several reasons, but it is quite interesting that the digital technology is changing the way that films are made.
Do you think there's a sense that it's value for money as well? Because nowadays going to the cinema is quite expensive.
I completely agree. I think that people taking their family out really want an evening's experience. They want to feel like they've got value for money. I mean, you look at the prices now in the West End, I mean, extraordinarily high, £15-16 for a single adult ticket. If you're taking the whole family out, I think people really do want to feel that the whole night has been spent well. So, yeah, I mean, I think Hollywood wants to prove that it's providing bang for the buck and putting it all up there as well. But I think, especially in these times when people are watching their pockets, tightening their belts maybe more than they have done in the past, I think it's very important for them to feel that they've had a long film-going experience.
It's interesting that you mentioned the West End, because I believe going to the cinema is becoming like almost going to see a play in the West End, because they're becoming so long. I believe in the future we might have a break between the first half of the film and then going to see the last half. What do you think?
Well, quite possibly. It depends quite how the audiences react. I mean, I remember, this is some time ago, watching Spike Lee's Malcolm X, and there was a break in that, but then that was about 5 hours. So I think even the hardiest of audiences would need a break then. But yeah, I think the longer the film gets, then I think people will start demanding it. You know, bladders will have their say in this, and filmmakers will listen.
And I know this extra length might work for some films, but do you really think that, for example, a film about robots, Transformers come to my mind, can last for 157 minutes?
I totally agree. It's absurd when something like this... I mean, Transformers is just it should be an 85, 90 minute schlocky popcorn movie. I mean, some of the comic book movies, The Dark Knight, they've actually tried to put backstory in, they've tried to make them much grittier, and so you can see why they go to over 2.5 hours. A movie like Transformers, there's absolutely no excuse at all. Although, as I was saying before, Hollywood does want to show with its blockbusters that you're getting bang for your buck. Whether the audiences really want to see an extra hour and a half of robots smashing each other up, I personally have my own views that they don't, and I think the critical acclaim, or the lack of critical acclaim, shows that as well. But I totally agree with you, there is no reason for Transformers 3 to be 157 minutes long.
Well, I hope not. And do you think there will be a kind of a backlash, and maybe there will be a time that we're going to return to a normal 90-minute film?
Well, I mean, obviously there are lots of 90-minute films coming out the whole time. I think it was interesting because one of the articles that suggested that audiences are getting tired of this, which I don't think they are, suggested that, you know, fans complain about the length of a movie. The only reason they complain about it, or the only time they complain about it, is when the movie is terrible. So with a film like Skyfall, for example, very few complaints over the running time. Some people have picked up on the plot points, things like that. But it's a very long movie for an action movie, and yet very rarely have people picked up on it because it was very well received. Yet there's a film like Cloud Atlas, which is not out in the UK yet, but has completely divided critics in the US, and it's had some very negative notices. And then people do complain about the length. If they're feeling the time, they really do not want to sit there for extended amounts of time if they're not enjoying themselves, and so that will become a major complaint, I think. But going back to your question, I think, you know, it's quite a hard thing to pin down because there are lots of movies and many of them are 80 minutes, 90 minutes long. It's just interesting at the moment that I think, you know, over the Christmas period, that some of the four or five of the major movies are so long. And I should also mention that perhaps part of the reason is the build-up to the Oscars. So some of the big movies that are trying to get consideration for February's ceremony really feel that they have to have that long running time to suggest that they're worthy of getting the big gong at the end of it all.
In a film like Cloud Atlas, how willing are the studios to maybe divide, to do like a prequel and a sequel, or just divide a film in two? Do you think, are they willing to do that, or they prefer to put into like a 180-minute film?
It's an interesting question. I think that it depends on the studios, but and also on the length of the movie. That really is, Cloud Atlas is on the cusp of thinking about dividing it. Tarantino with Kill Bill, he originally envisioned that as a single film. The studio there pushed him to divide it up. I think it really does come down to how strong the director is, whether he's a big name. Christopher Nolan, very few studios are going to tell him what to do and tell him to cut his movie or divide it in two. But also just whether it feels right for the film. I think Cloud Atlas is a pretty confusing movie anyway. I don't think cutting it into two would particularly help that. But it is something that film studios will have to think about. But also, given with some of the franchise films, given the Harry Potters and the Twilight movies, that they're willing to cut them into, and I mean, that's partly a reason to get more money in from the fans, obviously. But it does show that studios are increasingly considering this as an option, yeah.
And finally, Nick, I just want your predictions. Which film do you think is going to be the biggest blockbuster of the season?
Good question. The Hobbit's got a built-in audience. That's got to be up there. But I tell you, the critics are really going crazy for Les Miserables at the moment. It's directed by the guy who did The King's Speech. So a lot of people will be interested to see what his follow-up movie will be like. There's a lot of talk now I've seen in a couple of newspapers, including my own today, about Anne Hathaway's performance, even talk about her getting the Best Actress Oscar there. So I really think it'll be between those two, and at a pinch, I think I'd probably go for Les Mis.
And that was Nick Clarke, the arts correspondent for The Independent, talking to Fernando Augusto Pacheco earlier today. We shall stay with the filmic theme. This is Duran Duran. Duran Duran and Girls on Film being cut a little bit short there. You're with Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. Now, every week we like to go and meet our neighbours. This time we head to our office in New York, where our team visited the neighbouring Public Theatre. The Public Theatre in Astor Place is the only theatre in New York that produces Shakespeare, a new work in equal measure. Conceived nearly 60 years ago, it recently underwent a large revitalisation which gave birth to The Library, a cosy restaurant and a bar hidden in the building's mezzanine. We spoke to Kevin Abbott, Managing Director of The Library at the Public Theatre.
My name is Kevin Abbott. I'm the managing director and partner here at Joe's Pub at the Public Theatre and the Library at the Public Theatre. I have been here for 15 years, and we are in the, actually, NoHo, which is north of Houston. We are in the East Village, part of the Public Theatre. We opened in the beginning of October, and we opened as part of the what was called the revitalization of the Public Theatre. So it was an incredibly exciting time where we did literally 2 months of massive events, relaunching this building. We did parties that brought in over 10,000 people throughout this building in a relatively short period of time. We did a block party that they closed down Lafayette Street, and we did live entertainment, and we really brought people through this building to make them know that we are here, that this is a place that we want everyone to feel like this is part of their home.
I can see the reflection coming.
They didn't have turf color.
The building started off actually as the first library of New York City. It later became a home for Jewish immigrants that came into the city, and they came here first. It has that historical backing to it. In fact, on the north entrance, you can still see on the side of the building the markings for when it was that society. And then Joseph Papp took it over, started in the early 70s. And he transformed it into what is now known as the Public Theater, was the New York Shakespeare Festival, kind of one and the same. It is where the first show they did here was Hair, which they recently redid on Broadway. And they've done, you know, literally thousands of shows, both here and then up in the Delacorte Theater in Central Park. The food concept has actually really grown over the last 6 weeks. We have two different venues that we're primarily servicing here. We have Joe's Pub, which is a live music venue, and then we have the library. And they're two very different venues, but yet all coming from one kitchen. So the concept, we really wanted it to be friendly food that people can hang out, feel comfortable drinking these amazing cocktails that we have here, but at the same time having a really substantive meal. When they were designing the menu, they wanted to pay tribute to all the neighborhoods in this, because we are a melting pot here. And there's items like the pickle plate that we have, which is unbelievable array of different pickled items, and the goulash. It's a neighborhood that you really do find every ethnic background. You know, so we're trying to pay tribute to that by doing what Chef Carmelini calls American food, and the definition of American food is we're all different cultures. So a goulash is an American item here in the East Village. This building, you know, really has been an anchor to this neighborhood for the last 100 plus years. It establishes it as the artistic community that the Lower East Side really has always been. And it just grounds it in a way. And I think that anybody you talk to, it's a landmark that they know. You know, that if you can always use the Public Theater as a destination to give directions from. Well, you know where the Public Theater is, now go two blocks to the right and you can, you know where this or that is. So it really has been a constant. I think there's a really amazing thing happening in the East Village now, which is it has changed. It's really expanded. You know, the East Village used to be a much kind of smaller community, and now it's expanded, and the neighborhoods kind of blend, I think, a lot more than they used to, with, you know, the Bowery, which the Bowery is our neighbor by one block, and you hear so much about the Bowery as part of the East Village as well. But there are incredible restaurants and boutique shops, and kind of the East Village has kind of expanded kind of towards us over here on Lafayette Street, because technically we are in what's called NoHo. So that has kind of been its own little neighborhood, and the East Village is made up of all these little neighborhoods making up the larger East Village. And I just think it has really gentrified in a way, but in a positive way that makes it more accessible while keeping the historic part of what the East Village is. You know, it still is the East Village. It still has the artistic vibe that most neighborhoods don't have now in the city.
And that was Kevin Abbott, Managing Director of the Library Bar and Restaurant at the Public Theater in New York. And that's all we have time for today's Midori House. My thanks to our producer, Aled John, my researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, one day I'll get his name right, and to our studio manager, Sam Impey. Up next, after the news, is this week's episode of The Menu, hosted by Marcus Ippi. He'll be heading to South Africa to the Secret Festival, a weekend convention held in the country's Western Cape, looking for new frontiers in food.
So we just wanted to create a sense of generosity where we've asked even the market vendors, to each of them had like a family secret or a secret recipe that they shared with the market goers. And we've asked the speakers to also just share their secret.
In 3 hours' time at 2200 hours in London, Romas Vierzolas and Andrew Muller will be your hosts for The Monocle Daily. Midori House will be back at the same time. That's 1800 hours London time on Monday. But from me, Emma Nelson, thanks for listening and goodbye.